From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, jazz vocalist Gregory Porter reflects on his musical inspirations and his latest album, Take Me to the Alley. But first, the media is often criticized for excluding the voices of real people in its reporting. One show that bucks this trend, Democracy Now! It first aired in 1996 to cover that year's election. Since its launch, the show's host, Amy Goodman, and her team have covered major and underreported news from all over the world, all from a grassroots perspective. To mark the show's 20th year, Goodman has written a book called Democracy Now! 20 years covering the movements changing America. In it, she shares stories about the people she believes have moved the country forward in the last two decades. Take me back 20 years ago. I kind of referenced it a moment ago in the introduction to how Democracy Now! Actually got started.
So I got a call from Pacifica Radio. I was in a safe house in Haiti, covering the elections year there. This was after 3 years of President Aristide, who was thrown out, sadly, in a U.S.-backed coup. People were terrified of violence at the polls. Politicians, people who were running for office, were gunned down. And yet people still went to the polls, the overwhelming number of people. When I got the call to cover elections in the United States, you know, I was saying, my gosh, you know, half the people don't vote in the United States, and we face nothing like the adversity. So I was interested, why didn't people vote, and don't, overwhelmingly in this country, you know, to hover around 50, 60%. In most countries, most people, the vast majority of people do vote. And I didn't think it was apathy. I thought people were engaged in their communities, and what a great way in an election year to go from primary to caucus state and see what people were doing, how they were involved on the ground. But also, why they weren't voting, perhaps having to do with maybe they thought there wasn't a real choice between the major candidates. And, of course, there are the major obstacles that get, sadly, ever worse over the years to voting. When you have millions of people in this country who can't vote because somehow they were involved with the criminal justice system. In Maine and Vermont, you can vote from jail. But in a number of states in the United States, you can't vote even after you've served time in prison, came out, and you're all done with the criminal justice system. This disempowers so many communities. And then there's just simply the difficulty of voting in the United States.
I'm not naive, obviously, in asking this question, but over 20 years of covering these issues, what is behind the assault, the attack on voting rights? I mean, we live now, as I say all the time, in the most multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic America ever. We're about to come to the end of a two-year term of the first African-American president, and yet one can look at the data and see that there's still an assault and, in some ways, a more aggressive affront now to voting rights. What's behind that?
I mean, I think it's fear of those in power losing power. Who's in control in the state legislatures now? Who's in control in Congress? Right now, Republicans are, and they are concerned as the demographics of this country change, that their power base is changing and they may not be in power. So it is a last gasp of trying to stop large segments of the population, and particularly particular populations, from voting. I mean, look, Tavis, look at what happened in Arizona. In Phoenix alone, there were 200 polling places in 2012. Now, this election that is very contested in the primary, where clearly a lot of people were going to come out, the polling places were reduced from 200 to 60 in a population that has a very significant Hispanic population. People online, hour after hour after hour, five-hour lines. People, if they have a job, they can't go to leave work for 5 hours. It is making it virtually impossible for a number of people to vote. This is unacceptable.
How do you square that, though, with the notion that we gladly promote ourselves as the world's leading democracy? I mean, I remember researching this years ago, this voting issue, and I remember my shock at coming to discover that we vote on Tuesdays because years ago, that was the best day for farmers to get to the polls to vote. So we literally vote on Tuesday all these years later because that's the way it was back in the day. So if we call ourselves a democracy, why then not make, you know, a yeoman's effort, Saturday voting, more early voting, more same-day voting? Why not make it easier for fellow citizens to vote if that's what we That's what we revel in, which is the fact that we're a democracy.
I guess the question is who the we is in terms of that's what we revel in. If you don't want people to vote, you set up a system like we have in the United States. But that is not set in stone.
Right.
It can change. And there are powerful movements. I mean, I was in Selma last March on the 50th anniversary of the March on Selma. 100,000 people turned out to walk over the Edmund Pettus Bridge, named for the former U.S. Senator and Ku Klux Klansman, Edmund Pettus. 100,000. That's not, it just sort of naturally happened. That comes out of movements. People deeply concerned about what's happening in this country. And also, I think, in terms of culture, Ava DuVernay's film, Selma, we can't underestimate the power that had, not only in challenging what's going on in Hollywood right now, you know, the fact of the lack of the Oscar nominations and all of that, but these are all very significant. But, oh my gosh, how many people went to see that film in New York, where I come from? Mm-hmm. Middle school kids, high school kids were allowed to go watch it for free. And I think that had a tremendous effect on the population in this country. This was 50 years ago, and you had John Lewis's head bloodied as he tried to walk over the Edmund Pettus Bridge leading a Voting Rights Act. But where are we 50 years later? How is it that state after state is no longer being monitored by the government, and you have states coming out of that kind of monitoring, and they are making it increasingly difficult? But there is going to be pushback, and there is, and we will see what happens.
Let me ask a couple questions, if I can. I'm curious to get your take on this, about the state of our democracy. And there are two or three things I want to get at. Let me start with this. Every year, no matter who the president is, Republican or Democrat, black or white, every president uses the same line, it seems to me. They try to phrase it a little differently, but you can always wait for that line in the State of the Union address, that the state of our union is strong. Is the state of our democracy strong?
I think it's only as strong as the weakest among us, and that's what we really have to look at in this country. Where are we when it comes to issues of inequality, comes to issues of war and what we're doing abroad, comes to issues of climate change, the fate of the planet? These are all critical issues that will determine the fate not only of our country, but of the world. Where do we stand on these issues? How far have we progressed? For example, the immigrants' rights movement has been astounding, especially led by the young dreamers. And, you know, I'm on this 100-city tour, and everywhere we go, young people come up to me and say, I'm one of them. I'm one of those people because I talk in the talks about the bravery. I mean, young people who sit down in a Congress member's office or in President Obama's reelection campaign office in the last election and risk arrest, they're not just risking arrest. It's not just like a normal civil disobedience. They risk deportation. They risk their own deportation or of their loved ones, but they still did it. And they forced enormous change in this country. They couldn't change Congress, but they got President Obama to issue an executive order to defer to allow young people to stay in this country, and that has expanded. But at the same time, you have President Obama becoming what many mainstream immigration rights groups that worked with him in the White House and outside, the deporter in chief. How is it that the president who is elected by immigrants' rights groups and civil rights groups, women's rights groups, the peace movement, all the different human rights groups, has become the leading president when it comes to deportations? And on each of these issues, the inequality in this country is staggering. When you have more than 62, 63 people in the world, about 42-3 of them from the United States, having more wealth than a half the world's population, 3.5 billion people, we have to change this. And these movements are what will make the state of our democracy strong.
I want to ask you another question in a moment about our democracy. And the question essentially is whether or not we still live in a democracy. Is it still a democracy? Is it a plutocracy? Is it an oligarchy? We'll come to that in just a second. But before I go there, since you raised your critique of President Obama, let me ask you a question that I've been asked countless times over the last 8 years, and you know where I'm going with this. How does one offer a principled critique of the president as a progressive and stay on the air? How do you deal with the pushback? How do you deal with the
with the negativity that comes your way, because we're supposed to be in lockstep with the president and not critique him. I've gotten a lot of that myself, obviously, but how have you managed that?
I mean, we're journalists, yeah, and we should treat every president with the same principles that we approach all investigations and coverage. Fair and accurate, bringing out the voices of people at the grassroots. If we believe that people who care about war and peace, growing inequality, climate change, racial economic justice are not a fringe minority, not a silent majority, but the silenced majority, so often silenced by the corporate media, we have to bring out their voices. There were fierce critiques of President Bush. And then President Obama was elected. I think for many, I mean, they heaved a sigh of relief all over the globe because they felt they had hit their head against a brick wall for so long. The wall became a door. The door opened a crack. The question was, would it be kicked open or slammed shut? Think of who elected President Obama, all these different movements. And so what happened after he was elected? For one thing, I think there was a serious racist backlash, and that's the birther movement, you know, othering him. He doesn't look like us. He couldn't possibly be from here. And one of the people that led that movement to this day, Donald Trump. So I think those groups that deeply cared about equality and democracy were terrified of being lumped with a kind of racist backlash. But their demands, have they been met? I mean, President Obama immediately responded, said we're going to close Guantanamo, one of the first executive statements he made when he became president. It hasn't closed. It's been 7 years. Immigrants' rights activists making their demands for immigration reform. He's deported more immigrants than any president in U.S. history. And that's not Congress. That's President Obama.
What about war and peace? He has a Nobel Peace Prize.
He did get the Nobel Peace Prize and has expanded the drug war.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Amy Goodman, host of the acclaimed show Democracy Now!, and her team have covered major and underreported news from all over the world, all from a grassroots perspective. To mark the show's 20th year, Goodman has written a book called Democracy Now! 20 Years Covering the Movements Changing America. Goodman now reflects on the impact of grassroots progressive movements on America's social and political landscape.
You know, it's very interesting. A few years ago, I was invited on by one of the networks to talk about the day President Obama gave his speech at the National Defense University. Remember when Medea Benjamin, the Code Pink founder, she protested, right? And she was questioning Obama from her seat in the audience before they dragged her out or carried her out. And she was saying, I love my country. What happened to Tariq Aziz, a teenager who was killed in a drone strike in Pakistan? What happened to Abdurrahman Alaki, a 16-year-old Denver-born teen who was killed in a drone strike in Yemen. And she wanted answers as he was talking about the drone war. And she was taken out. Interestingly, he said, you should listen to that woman. I was called by the network to say, would you come on and talk about what she did? And I said, oh, well, I watched it like you did on television. It was very interesting. And they said, well, would you come on and talk about it? I said, well, I actually don't think Medea Benjamin was jailed, as she is in a number of has been a number of times. I think you could talk to her. She was there. She'll tell you exactly what she said. Oh, no, you know we couldn't bring her on. I said, really? Why? And I think that's the power of Democracy Now! It's the power of your show, Tavis. It's going to where the silence is. It is bringing out the voice of the grassroots, which, by the way, are not silent. They are noisy. They're just silenced by the corporate media. And it is so important to hear their voices. How do I cover President Obama the same way I covered President Bush? Bringing out the voices of people in this country.
But the truth, as you well know, is unsettling. It is unhousing. It is inconvenient, it's uncomfortable, it gets you in trouble. How have you stayed, how has Democracy Now! Stayed on the air for 20 years?
Well, we started on 9 community radio stations in 1996. In 1997, I would like to say we expanded, but we reduced by one because we dared to air the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal at the time on death row in Pennsylvania. When we have this controversial practice in this country of the death penalty, it's absolutely critical that we hear from both sides of the bars. We go behind the bars and the bars behind the bars when we're talking about the death penalty. He wasn't talking about his own case. Mm-hmm. He was talking about father hunger, the prisoners who didn't have fathers. He was talking about capital punishment being punishment for those without capital. And we felt it was our responsibility, if we could get these tapes, to play them. We had the Society of Professional Journalists on that day. They were astounded at what happened, that the Temple University Network mm-hmm. in Pennsylvania, that ran Democracy Now!, dumped us unceremoniously, saying that the listeners wanted to hear more jazz. I was insulted as a jazz mm-hmm. lover, especially because their folio had gone out. Their program guide had already gone out, and it mm-hmm. said Democracy Now! Is an example of one of their most successful programs, mm-hmm. and they were using it as a model for their other programs. I hope everyone else didn't get thrown off too. But we persisted because that is our job as journalists, again, to go to where the silence is. And then station by station began to pick us up. The week of September 11, 2001, we went on our first TV station, public access TV station in New York, Manhattan Neighborhood Network. And we were emergency broadcasting the closest national broadcast to Ground Zero, both the TV and radio show R1. And then community stations around the country, TV stations, would say, can we go? Can we run Democracy Now!? We started sending out FedEx because it was breaking news. Mm-hmm. The FedEx guys would come with huge hefty bags and fill those hefty bags with our video cassettes. And before you know it, the NPR stations would say, can we run Democracy Now!? The PBS stations would say, could we run Democracy Now!? And now stations around the world, we perfected a way to send broadcast quality video through the internet. Our radio and television shows in South Africa and Japan and Sweden multiple times in the day. Through Europe, Latin America, we translate our headlines into Spanish, incorporating the internet from the very first day into the way we transmit the show. You know, we have to keep the internet open and free. We have to build independent media around the world that's not sponsored by the oil companies.
I was going to say, that takes money. And I've been on your show, been honored to be a guest a number of times over the years. And I know that you don't have, for that matter, we don't either on PBS, but you don't have the money, the advertisers that ABC and CBS and NBC and Fox have. So how do you stay on the air? Where's the money come from 20 years later?
I mean, it's about listener and viewer and reader support and some money from foundations, the critical love of independent media. I think that independent media is the oxygen of a democracy, and the reason for Democracy Now!'s growth is the love of authentic independent voices that will determine where we go mm-hmm. in this country.
Let me go back to the question that I said I wanted to get back to before our conversation ends. So there's a great deal of consternation and I think conversation about the state of our democracy and whether or not we're moving dangerously close to being a plutocracy or maybe even an oligarchy. What's your sense of where we are in this democracy?
Well, I an incurable optimist. I am steeped in the movements that have so much passion, deep belief in where our country could be. And so I would err on the side of it is going in the right direction, even when we see the clampdown every which way. I mean, when you see the evolution of these movements, I mean, just look at the Black Lives Matter movement mm-hmm. now in the 2016 presidential campaign. Okay, the corporate networks aren't going to give them a microphone, so they grab that microphone at the town hall meetings of Hillary Clinton, of Bernie Sanders.
Of Bill Clinton.
Of Bill Clinton. Yeah. Truly yeah. astounding. Yeah. And they are changing the agenda of the candidates are being forced to incorporate their demands. And it's extremely important. Hundreds of people being arrested in Washington, demanding an end to the saturation of, to the money dominating politics. All of this is not going to be raised in the commercial media because they're making the money. Why are these candidates raising the money? Millions and millions of dollars for airtime. Mm-hmm. And so who is profiting from that? The corporate networks, they're hardly going to raise this issue over and over again. I'm not saying once or twice. You could always give me an example once or twice of a network raising this. Mm-hmm. But it's the daily drumbeat that matters. We need a media that's not brought to us by the oil companies when we cover climate change, that's not brought to us by the weapons manufacturers when we cover war, not brought to us by the insurance industry when we cover healthcare.
What's been fascinating for me, I won't say shocking because I wasn't really shocked by it, but these network heads are even bragging about how well they're doing. I mean, when I saw Jeff Zucker who's my friend, I love him, but Jeff Zucker at CNN is bragging about how good this is. Les Moonves at CBS is bragging. I mean, you got network heads now who are not even trying to act like they're not making a bunch of money off
of it. And they have a responsibility that they are completely violating. Look at the Tyndall Report 2015. Donald Trump gets 23 times the coverage of Bernie Sanders. What ABC World News Tonight in the year 2015 devotes something like 81 minutes to Donald Trump, 20 seconds to Bernie Sanders. You have a skewed coverage. Donald Trump doesn't have to leave one of his gold-gilded mansions to campaign. He's piped into everyone's home.
No, he's calling in on the phone.
That's right, something that the other candidates had not been allowed to. And then you have, for example, I think it was Super Tuesday 3. That was the five states. It was Ohio, Kasich won for the first time. It was Florida, and Rubio pulled out. It was North Carolina. It was Missouri, and it was Illinois. Missouri and Illinois, too close to call, neck and neck, Clinton and Sanders. The other three, Clinton had won. And each of the candidates, you watched their speeches, concession or victory speeches. And then came, you had Cruz speaking, Rubio speaking, Clinton speaking, Kasich speaking. Then they were waiting for Donald Trump at the empty podium at one of his Florida mansions, waiting and waiting, filling airtime because they were all doing the coverage. I didn't know. What happened to Bernie Sanders? Had he gone to sleep that night? Where was Bernie Sanders? It was neck and neck. Three primaries had been called, but two we were waiting to see. In fact, he was giving a speech before thousands of people in Phoenix, Arizona. They just didn't play it.
Better Trump. Better to not play Bernie and get caught with Trump walking to the podium, and you can't cut away from Bernie to go to Trump. That looks too bad. So you just don't cover Bernie.
Well, another time Trump, what they did is they played Trump for his hour. They held on to Hillary Clinton's speech. They played it afterwards. They didn't even bother to do that, and you had all the networks. We played on Democracy Now! The next day a clip of Bernie Sanders, and all I will say is I never thought it would be a revolutionary act to play a clip of a major party candidate giving a speech, but in this country, it has become that. We need a free and open and fair media.
I got 1 minute to go. Tell me what's inside of the book, Democracy Now!
It's the 20-year journey of Democracy Now! From 9 community radio stations to over 1,400 and continuing to grow because people want a free and fair and open media, hearing the great diversity of voices, connecting those with this country around the world, a media that knows no borders.
The new book celebrating 20 years of a brilliant and wonderful and powerful and much needed program called Democracy Now! The book is called Democracy Now! 20 years covering the movements changing America by Amy Goodman, the fine host of that program, co-authored with David Goodman and Dennis Monahan. Amy, I am so grateful for you. You are an authentic American hero, and I'm always honored to have you on this program.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. There was a time when jazz singer Gregory Porter thought he'd have a career in football. A talented athlete, Porter attended San Diego State on a full sports scholarship. Then a serious shoulder injury ended his dream. But that life-changing moment put him on a path of musical self-discovery and growth. In 2010, he released his first album called Water. Since then, he's attracted a diverse fan base and garnered accolades, including a Best Vocal Jazz Album Grammy in 2014. He joins us now to talk about his latest offering, Take Me to the Alley. You been good, man?
I've been good, brother. Thank you so much.
I know you've been good, man. Can I just tell you, it's just a point of personal pride. as one of the first persons to have you on way back when.
Yeah.
And I didn't, and there were others who discovered you before I did, but just to have you on this national program years ago, to just see the ground that you have covered, I mean, it just makes my heart glad, man.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. It's been amazing. And thank you for your help.
No, I mean, I didn't mean that. I just, you love rooting for somebody.
Yeah.
And especially somebody like you, because we live in a time, in a moment where everything has to have so many bells and whistles all around it just to get noticed, just to get heard.
Yeah,
And otherwise, it's just kind of hard to break through all the other noise.
Yeah,
but you just sing.
Yeah, and you know, I think sometimes people ask me, well, where were you when you were 25?
Yeah.
I still had this kind of same message, but it took me a while to figure out what it is, how I wanted to say it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just being myself and telling my story and observing life and love and singing about it.
Yeah. What has allowed, let me set your ask you to set your modesty aside for just a second, aside from the beautiful, the richness of your voice, what do you think in a world where there is so much noise out there has allowed you in this instrument to just break through?
I think, to go back to my last record, Liquid Spirit, that lyric of the song, the people are thirsty because of man's unnatural hand. Mm-hmm. Watch what happens when the people catch wind of water hitting the banks of that hard, dry land.
Yeah.
As water is the metaphor for music and for something beautiful, people are ready for just an honest, straightforward, you know, message like that, and uncomplicated, and now I hear, I notice from my audiences, people want something where they can go and take their mother and take their son.
Mm-hmm.
The concerts are really generational.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, you know, 9-year-olds, the mother, and then the grandmother. So it's cool.
Yeah.
How has the success so far, to the extent that it has, affected your songwriting or the time it takes to write songs?
I write on the move. Yeah, I write when I'm in motion. So traveling 300 days a year.
You on the move.
I'm right. Being on the road.
You got a lot of content there, right?
Right. That helps. There's some of it in this. Being away from home.
Mm-hmm.
And can cause you to think about home differently.
Yeah.
Home is in people for me now.
Yeah.
No matter what happens to my home, if it burns down, it's flooded, or falls down, my home is in people. It's in my brother.
Yeah.
It's in my loved ones. Mm. It's in the friends that I create all over the world. That way, I still feel like I got something.
Yeah.
Being away from the places and that you consider home, family, and your favorite coffee shop and your church. There's a lyric in one of my songs, A Consequence of Love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the lyric is, I begin to hate time and distance because it keeps me away from you. And that's being on the road and the success has caused this energy inside of me that makes me long for home and think about it and consider it, and I write about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have a 3-year-old son.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about what I want to say to him, and I miss him. And so I write a song about him called Don't Lose Your Steam.
Yeah.
You know, it's about my mother gave me something, and now it's my turn to give him something that I hope that he takes to the other side and gives to his son or his daughter.
Yeah.
So it's, legacy.
Yeah.
You know, don't lose your head of steam. Don't lose your head of dreams.
Yeah.
Don't lose your personal integrity. Keep going. If the bottom falls out, if the walls fall down, don't stop. Keep going.
Yeah.
And I think if I could.
Please. Keep, absolutely. Go on. You preach it now. Go ahead. you like your mama now. So go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, think in a way, it could be myself realizing that I wanted a male figure when I was young to have some expectations of me and some goals for me and some a little pushing. I didn't have it. My mother was there doing it all the way.
Sure.
But I didn't have my father doing it. And so I think I'm not overcompensating, but I'm carefully thinking about just being there to say, you know, I'm counting on you, son.
Yeah.
You know.
How does that lack impact and affect the way you are fathering your 3-year-old son?
It makes me conscious of what I'm saying, what I'm doing, what I'm exposing him to, and I'm there to let him know. I'm just constantly letting him know I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, even when I'm away, I'm flying him all over. He's been to more countries than.
Yeah. He has a passport, huh?
Yeah, he has a passport, and it's getting kind of full.
Getting kind of full, yeah.
Yeah, and it causes me to just let him know I'm there. I'm between being there physically and Skype, I'm there every day, and I'm just I know what I lacked, I know what I missed, and it just causes me to think of all of these things that I want to do, from baseball to fishing, all of these little, I find myself on the internet looking for little, he's not ready to go fishing yet, three. He's not going to touch a fish, but I find myself shopping for little fishing rods and all kinds of things like that, because I remember the lack, and I had a sophisticated understanding of that lack, which is why we talked about it last time, which is why I gravitated to Nat King Cole's music. I was like, there's my daddy, you know?
Yeah. why Take Me to the Alley?
Take Me to the Alley is, I talk about my mother's influence in my life all the time, but Take Me to the Alley is about, the lyric is, they gild their houses in preparation for the king, and they line the sidewalks with every sort of shiny thing, but they will be surprised when the king says, take me to the alley, take me to the afflicted ones, take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. It's my mother's energy. We would literally drive down the street and look for people who were in trouble, on drugs or alcohol or in need. Mm-hmm. And my mother was gravitated to those people, not to people who already had everything. Sometimes our churches can be that way. It's like, we can cater to ourselves, but there's some people out there that are in the dark places, that are suffering, that really need the help. And you'll have more effect there than you will, given to the people at the top. Don't want to offend nobody, but there's plenty of people out there that need help, and real help.
Your mother, to be sure, who we talked about the last time you were on, and it's impossible to have any conversation with you longer than 5 minutes and your mama's name not come up.
I know.
Whether you're on TV or not, trust me, I know this. Mama is present in the conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
So your mother clearly and surely had her own ministry.
Yeah.
But I get the sense, the more I listen to you, that music is not just a gift for you, it's not just a profession, but that you see this as a ministry.
Yeah, you say something that I think I kind of, I don't steer clear of it, because I don't feel like it's a ministry. These are things that I want to say to people. They're inspirational, they're uplifting, and yes, it is a ministry, but if I say that it is, somehow you can people feel like that you're gonna beat them over the head, or you're judgmental, or you're, and I'm not that way. Nor was my mother. Mm-hmm. She used to sit down and have lunch with prostitutes, to bring them in, and have a conversation with them, and to look at them eye to eye. Now, if you're up here and say this is who I am, you'll frighten those people away. So, yes, it is. It's coming from, much of what I sing, it comes from my mother's energy. And once I started to do that, once I started to latch onto that thing, the roots of my being is when my success started to happen. Mm-hmm. So,
how are you navigating, speaking of the alley, being appreciated and welcome and heard in the alleys, as well as on the stages of the finest venues in the world?
Yes, I pinch myself. I really do. I was performing at the Royal Albert Hall.
Sold out, I'm told.
Sold out.
Yeah. Sold out.
In London. But this was another. Yeah. This was another time I was there.
Yeah.
And the Queen was in her box, and I was like, what am I doing? How did I get here? You know. And my mother predicted it, so there you go. Yeah. I'm dealing with it quite well, because I think as an artist, you should be able to go to the highest places and to the lowest places and still be yourself and be appreciated and liked in both places.
Yeah. Yeah.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. My conversation with Grammy Award-winning jazz vocalist Gregory Porter concludes.
Do you ever fret, do you ever fear, ever think about getting lost, losing your way? And that's a strange question perhaps to ask, but there's a litany of individuals who started where you started and climbed in the way that you're climbing. And somewhere along the way, they kind of got off path.
Yeah. I think because I came to my success a bit later in life, I kind of, I think I'm a bit more steady. It can happen to anyone. I mean, the temptations and opportunities to do wrong are everywhere. They really are everywhere in entertainment. But I feel like it's just like my lyrics. I mean, I have these ancestors on my shoulders that I don't want to disappoint, and my personal integrity. And so no, I think I'm gonna be okay. You know, and I'm singing songs of a life story that may have gotten off track.
Yeah.
But getting back on track is what's most important, where you end up.
Yeah. Have you gotten to the point yet, and I ask this, I have my own personal story here, but have you gotten to the point yet where, as you travel, there are now songs in your repertoire that people are demanding to hear you sing, or stuff that you know that you have to sing before you get off the stage? Is that starting to happen now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Give me a couple of them.
No Love Dying.
There you go.
Yeah.
That better be on the list.
I think it's also because it's people can tell that I want to say that to the world.
Yeah. But that it's let me just cut it here. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
It's that lyric, man.
Yeah.
The lyric, the just top to bottom.
Yeah.
The lyrics to No Love Dying Here is just it's.
Yeah. I love saying anywhere in the world. I mean, from Tel Aviv to Bahrain.
Yeah.
Standing on the middle of the stage, there's some doubt that's out about this love, but I won't let it be. There will be no love that's dying here for me, and I mean that love. And you can take it romantically if you want to, but I mean it in the most that universal way, of gracious way.
Last time I saw you, you were with Diana Krall.
Yeah.
So by now, I assume that you've had a chance to play with some people that you perhaps never imagined you'd be hanging out with. So I'm just curious. I'm being fanboy now.
Yeah.
So tell me who you've been hanging out with and singing with of late that you like and you got friendships with now.
Yeah, well, Herbie Hancock.
Yeah. I saw you, Renee Fleming, on something.
Renee Fleming.
Yeah.
I was with Bonnie Raitt in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Stevie Wonder came onto my stage.
Hold on. We got to take a moment for that.
Yeah. So,
I say this in all seriousness because, I mean, my heart is still broken by the loss of Prince, who's a friend of mine, and I'm still trying to process Whitney and Luther and Michael and Maurice White and Natalie Cole. I'm just trying to process. It's just happening too fast for me.
Yeah.
So I take a moment here because when Stevie walks on stage and does something with you.
Yeah.
That's like a moment, man.
It was a moment.
Yeah.
It was a moment.
Yeah.
And he was just so casual. He's like, let's do whatever you want to do. I'm like, don't you know, I learned my first dance steps to you. I've learned how to get this singing thing together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of the fabric of so much of life.
Yeah.
You know, that music was in the background doing a whole bunch of things, you know. Whether it was study, washing dishes, whatever it was, and so he came on stage and had his harmonica in hand, and he said, "I want to play one of your songs." I was like, and then quoted my lyrics, and it just so we developed this friendship and this respect, and so it's just been gracious, and I hear that he wrote some music for me, but I haven't heard it yet.
Yeah.
So. But I'll be glad to see you.
You better get that.
Yeah.
for those who haven't heard you as yet, and they're discovering Gregory Porter for the first time, first of all, where you been? But secondly, how would you describe? I keep reading all the beautiful things and the wonderful things that critics are saying about you, music critics. How would you describe your music?
I would say that it's in a way, the musical diaspora, I would say there's gospel, blues, and soul. But it's through the synthesis of jazz.
Yeah.
I'm a jazz singer, but I'm borrowing from all of the cousins of the music. And you know, these the lines of genre are, in a way, are unnatural, are that unnatural hand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So this is, it's a family of music, and I employ all of it in my approach. Because that's the way I grew up listening to music, and
yeah.
And most people do love Stevie and Coltrane at the
yeah.
same time.
Yeah,
you know, it's the, in a way, it's an equal spirit.
Sure. Yeah. Before I let you get busy doing this performance today that we're all anxious to see and hear, what are your expectations of this project? And I ask that because once you hit it so hard the way you deal with Liquid Spirit,
yeah.
your expectations might not be the same as the record companies, not the same as the music critics. And so what's success for you with Take Me to the Alley?
Well, this the thing is I've been around these artists like Stevie and Bonnie Raitt and artists who have been around for a long, long time. With this project, I want it to be the acceptance that I can just keep going, keep producing projects, keep producing quality music that people will enjoy. I hope this equals or surpasses Liquid Spirit. Yes, that's the...
That ain't gonna be easy to do.
Right. but you know, I was in Belfast, and Van Morrison is sitting in the stands, and then he comes and talks to me after the concert. And to have that type of career of where you can just allow to keep experiencing life, writing about it, and then the opportunity to perform it on stage. That's the kind of career I want, and I want this to be a building block of that.
Well, you are well on your way. We're honored to have a performance from him after I tell you that the new project from Mr. Porter is called Take Me to the Alley, and up next, a performance of the title track, Take Me to the Alley. Good to have you back on, brother.
Thank you.
Well, they build their houses in preparation for the king, and they line the sidewalks with every sort of shiny thing, but they will be surprised when they hear him say, take me to the alley, take me to the afflicted ones, take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. King, and they line the sign walks with every sort of expensive and shiny thing, but they will be surprised, oh, when they hear His Majesty say, take me to the alley. Take me to the afflicted ones. Take me to the lonely ones that somehow lost their way. Let them hear. Listen to me, rest here in my garden. Rest here in my garden.
You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.